this episode of the UND Potluck Podcast, where we host conversations about the arts, English 479 students, Sophia Atkinson, Abby Bailey, Sierra Durbin, Destiny Guidry, Sam Jackson, Alex Phillips Hedge, Ethan Thurston, and Dylan Torres, interview the 2022 Whirling Prize winner. Etchings Press, a student-run publisher at University of Indianapolis, awards the Whirling Prize in Prose to a book that demonstrates an excellent and compelling response to a theme selected by students. The 2022 theme was Young Adults Exploring the Mysterious, and in this podcast, the student judges have a conversation with novelist Donna Gordon, author of the winning book, What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me. Donna Gordon is a fiction writer and visual artist from Cambridge, Massachusetts. In addition to her debut novel, What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me, her short stories have appeared in Tin House, Plowshares, the Boston Globe Magazine, Story Quarterly, and other magazines. Her work with former political prisoners culminated in Putting Faces on the Unimaginable, Portraits and Interviews with Former Prisoners of Conscience, exhibited at Harvard's Fogg Museum. We hope you enjoy this episode of UIndy's Potluck Podcast.
Welcome, readers. I am Abby Bailey. We are talking with Donna Gordon, author of What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me, which explores the story of Lee, a 13-year-old boy who is facing premature death from progeria, a premature aging disease. His character, Thomas, a survivor of Argentina's dirty war who is searching for his missing wife, and Lee's single mother, Cass, overwhelmed by love for her son and the demands of her work as a Broadway makeup artist. A mix-up prevents Cass from taking Lee on his final wish trip to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia to pursue his interest in the life of Ben Franklin. Thomas offers to accompany Lee on the trip as one flees memories of death and the other hurdles inevitably towards it. They each share unsettling truths and find themselves transformed in the process. The Whirling Prize judges were immersed in this book, and we are excited to have this opportunity to talk to you about your work. Let's meet the team.
I'm Ethan Thurston.
I'm Sam Jackson.
I'm Alex Phillips Hedge.
I'm Sierra Durbin.
I'm Sophia Atkinson.
I'm Destiny Guidry.
I'm Dylan Torres.
All right, let's get started. Welcome, Donna Gordon.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for choosing What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me for the Whirling Prose Prize. I'm very honored and very appreciative of all the written feedback you sent. So thank you for that.
Why choose characters who have progeria within the novel? And do you know someone with it or have a personal connection to progeria?
Yes, actually, I had volunteered at Camp Sunshine in Sebago, Maine. Camp Sunshine is for kids who have life-threatening illnesses and their families. And I had volunteered to photograph the kids. And while I was there, I met kids who not only had cancer and leukemia and things like that, but there was a boy I met who had progeria, which is a premature aging disease. So even though he was only about 12 years old, he had the appearance of about an 80-year-old, and his biology was accelerated, but his mind was not. So he was a very alert, interesting person. About the same time, I had done a volunteer project with Amnesty International, for which I photographed and interviewed 15 people on their speakers list. And those people were from all over the world, and they had been tortured and detained and under house arrest, varying consequences for so-called crimes against their government. So I did meet two people from Argentina at that time, two of which had survived the dirty war in Argentina, which took place between 1976 and 1983. And so when I was putting the novel together, I combined the character I met who had progeria with sort of a composite of characters I met who had been from Argentina. And so that's how I first learned about progeria and started my story.
Why did you choose to include the story and plotline of Tomas when the story could have focused solely on Lee?
It could have. You're right about that. But I sort of, in my mind as a writer, I put them in a room together for some reason, because I think I just sensed they had connections. And as I thought about it, I realized they did have the connection. They both struggled with issues about time. And for Lee, that was accelerated time. And for Tomas, it was lost time. And so they started to become, for me, a sort of interesting counterpoint. And they needed one another in order to play out their stories and their lives. And so I think putting them together intensified that experience and allowed for the journey to happen. And so I think without Tomas, Lee would not have developed and evolved and learned all the things he did along the way. And without Lee, Tomas would not have expanded his kind of sense of humanity and his sort of confidence to go on his journey to look for his missing family. So they wound up needing each other more than they realized. So I think that sort of became an integral part of the story for me and the storytelling.
Is there any particular reason you wanted Lee to be obsessed with Ben Franklin in the story?
Yeah, I think so. Lee is an American history buff. He's an autodidact. He's self-taught. And his life is so sort of precarious that he's sort of devoted himself to the facts of American history, because that helps him ground himself in some structure. And I think that knowing all the time how short his life is going to be, and knowing that at any time he could die of a heart attack or stroke, which is what happens to kids who have progeria, the sort of average life expectancy is now about 15. At the time that my story is set, it's the 1980s, not as much was known about the gene, but now there's a Progeria Research Foundation. And so a lot more is known and kids are living a little bit longer. But Lee, he's sort of on his own, and he has a great sense of humor. He has a pet, his pot-bellied pig is his pet. He sort of has a inventive, humorous personality. And because he's also an American history buff, it made sense to me that Ben Franklin would resonate for him. And he has a lot in common with Ben. They're both self-taught. They're both inventive and humorous. Ben Franklin at one point wrote an elegy to a squirrel, and he's just been involved in a lot of interesting things. So I felt that Lee sort of needs someone to check in with. And at times in the book, he'll say to himself, what would Ben Franklin do? What would Ben Franklin think? And so I put Ben Franklin in there as a sort of companion for Lee before he had Tomas. And that sort of helped him with his loneliness, his sort of intellect. He's pretty advanced, and it sort of gave him someone to admire and model himself after in some ways. So it just made sense to me that Ben Franklin would fit in. And also I understand that, you know, the world knows Ben Franklin. There's a lot of resonance there for readers and a lot of recognition. So I also did, as a strategy, think it would help people feel connected. So that was another reason for including Ben Franklin.
Did you include Kira's character to push along Lee's story to help with its growth and change? How do you make these decisions about character and plot in your writing?
Kira sort of continued in the book even after she was gone, even after she was physically gone. But I did think a while about whether or not to have her die so early on in the story, but then I felt like I needed to in order to help catapult Lee and Tomas on their journey, because it sort of forced Lee and Tomas to be together and come to terms with one another and go on the journey to complete the rest of the story. But it was difficult to do, to do that to her. And people still ask me, why did you need to kill her? But I felt it was important to, like I said, to move the story along. The structure of the story is a journey, and that structure really helped me write the book, because I knew that I knew where I was headed. I didn't quite know how I was going to get there, but it helped me move the story along. The way I think about writing this story is as if I were going down a very long hallway and opening doors on either side and going in each of those rooms where I've opened the door and sort of looking around, creating a scene, and then moving back to the hallway, which is sort of the plot line, and then going down a bit farther and maybe opening a door on the other side of the hallway and going in that room and looking around. So that sort of helped me think about the story and also slow myself down in order to describe things well. And so I'd put myself in the room and force myself to look around at what I was seeing, and then took my time to describe it. I'm also a visual artist, I'm a painter and printmaker. And so I have a lot of crossover between my verbal and my visual experience. It was hard to know whether or not, going back to the original question, it was hard for me to know whether or not to include Tomas. Some people who've read the book have asked me, whose story is it? Is it Lee's or is it Tomas's? And it's definitely Lee's story, but Tomas's story was important for the reasons I already described, and also because I wanted to talk about human rights, and I wanted to talk about the dirty war in Argentina and the abuelas and the search for missing children, and I wanted to talk about what happened to the mothers who gave birth to babies who were then taken away and given up for adoption. And a lot of those mothers were loaded into a plane and thrown out into the sea over Uruguay. There's a lot of details that I wanted people to know about. And so the story was a vehicle for a lot of those things. I think a novel allows one to really talk about so many things on your mind as opposed to a short story, which has to be much more contained. So I think the novel really is a great vehicle for exploring anything that you want to, if you can find a way to connect things you're interested in. And I think that's what I tried to do.
When you are writing about something as bleak and emotionally difficult as this, how do you deal with it? In other words, what do you do when it starts to become overwhelming?
It was overwhelming. It was definitely overwhelming. And people have asked me how I could write a story about two characters whose lives were so dark. But to me, they were never dark. To me, as I invented my characters, as they developed, as I grew to know them better, and they were more a part of me and I was part of them, I was engaged with their spirits, their adventure, their ways of connecting. And it was difficult to talk about Lee's illness. It was difficult to talk about what had happened to Moss during his times when he was tortured, but together they sort of gave one another hope and they became more. So, and I also think that Lee's mother, Cass, couldn't afford to just worry about the tragedy of her son's illness. And she had to be upbeat too. And I think that in the writing itself, the language sort of becomes a different dimension. And so I think a lot of what happens in my book is not just the story, but it's the language that is part of the experience. And I think the language keeps it from being dark as well. Also, Lee has a unique sense of humor. And I included Patrick as a sort of comic relief, sort of like the fool that Shakespeare includes in his plays. And that was totally intentional to do that so that it wouldn't feel as dark. I think the way Lee thinks in his inventive way and the connections he makes and his interest in the hula hoop and bubble gum and things like that, I think those sort of lightened some of the facts of their lives and their fates. And so I think that I was very consciously doing those things because I didn't want to tell a story that was leaden. I wanted to tell a story that was animated, and because I loved my characters, I loved all of them, you know, one at a time and combined. And that's part of the, I don't want to say the joy, it's part of the wonder of being a writer, because you are all of your characters and you make decisions back and forth. Would they do this? Would they do that? What's going to happen? And for me, so much of the experience of being a writer is in the writing itself. And I wanted my characters to have as much dimension as I could imagine. And so I'm very happy that they seem to exist apart from me. You know, they seem to have become themselves. And so that's why I don't feel, it was very sad for me to have Lee die in the end. I cried, I miss him. I didn't want that to happen. And yet I knew it was inevitable. And it was very hard for me to write about some of the things that Tomas endured, because those stories are real. And the people I met 15 people who had atrocious things happen to them. And to really know that these things are going on, not just in the lives of the people I met, but all over the world today, things we don't even know about, is very sobering. And I did feel I needed to tell the truth of the people I had met with, because they had told me that they needed witnesses, that having witnesses to their experiences helped them sort of heal. I don't think they ever really heal, but having witnesses hear their stories and know about them helped them a lot with their own survival. So there were a lot of things to consider, and I hope I did justice to their stories.
That's really awesome, because like you said, it could be pretty challenging. So along with that, were there any other like challenges that you faced while writing this book, like a specific one that you struggled with, and how did you overcome those challenges?
I think I struggled a lot to give Lee a sense of dignity, a quality that I felt he deserved, and a sense of his own uniqueness that could be appreciated by, you know, everyone. I think people who have progeria or any other abnormality or affliction or difference are not well understood and not always respected. And so that was very much on my mind. There's a quote I have in the beginning of my book, which I think sort of carried me a little bit. It's by Diane Orbis. I'll just read it. There's a quality of legend about freaks, like a person in a fairy tale who stops you and demands that you answer a riddle. Most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've already passed their test in life. They're aristocrats. And so I always have thought about that. I have had a sister who was schizophrenic and sort of like a street person, and people would cross the street when they'd see her coming. And so I've always been sensitive to differences. And I think that, you know, one of the challenges was how to give Lee that sense of dignity without making it seem like I was pointing too hard in that direction. And so that was one challenge. I struggled to make my characters interconnect and have a sense of affecting one another. I struggled with the plot. I struggled with putting in false starts for Lee and Tomas before they eventually found the right clues to finding his missing wife and child. I struggle with dialogue. That's always hard for me. I think I struggle with wanting to do right by each of my characters. That was very much on my mind. I started out as a poet, and I studied poetry in college and afterward, and I hadn't ever really studied the formal elements of fiction writing. So it was a challenge for me to try to actualize that and make sure I was creating a whole world here that would move. And so I think I worked pretty hard. I revised the whole novel from start to finish, three or four times at least. And I was in a writing workshop with two other women, and that was really helpful to me because they gave me feedback about, you know, getting a good perspective on what my characters might realistically do. And so that was a good check and balance for me to have that feedback from those people. But some of the challenge was to believe in myself as a writer. I'd say that was also true. Some of it was to feel convinced that I had done enough. And so there's always a question about that. Have I done enough? Have I done it well enough? Is this story credible? And I think that testing that out is always scary. You're probably all, I don't know if many of you are writers yourselves, but you know, there's always self-doubt. So I think I learned a lot along the way writing this novel. And I think I learned to trust my sense of self and my sense of truth and my sense of working hard, because the language was revised quite a bit and I wasn't willing to just let it go easily. I wanted it to be the best that I could manage. So those are all some of the challenges specific to me.
So just a question about Cass. Is there any reason why you made her a single mom? Is there a reason why you made Lee's dad a deadbeat ice cream maker?
That's a good question. I felt that they were going to be struggling against a lot of odds. And I also think that when parents have a child who has a life-threatening disease like that, it's very divisive. And I think that a lot of families can't handle it. And in Cass's situation, her husband, Neil, couldn't handle it. And it also, it seemed like for me that it would be a stronger, more dramatic situation if it was just the two of them. And it was a way to get to know their inside lives better. It's a bit of a stereotype, I guess, to create a deadbeat dad, but it also opened the door for Lee to create a bond with Tomas. And the fact that his father wasn't there gave Lee that opportunity to embrace Tomas. And it also gave Tomas the opportunity to sort of think of Lee as his child in a way. So I think that that was part of the intent. And Cass just sort of came to me pretty fully born. I just sort of perceived her and her world and her persona. So it just sort of was how I envisioned the family. I didn't want her to be a stereotypical mom, and I don't think she is. I tried to show her own self-doubt and uncertainty about her worth as a mother. And having volunteered at Camp Sunshine in Sebago, Maine, and having met with a lot of families who had kids with life-threatening illnesses, you could see sort of the polarization that can happen in a marriage or a relationship when a child is struggling like that. There's a lot of differences of opinion about how to handle it emotionally. And I think it's very difficult, and people, you know, they sometimes blame one another, or they can't deal with that intense pain. It's very difficult. So that was part of my thinking.
Wow, that's really enlightening, Ms. Gordon. It sounds like you've had a lot of inspirations and influences in writing this book, but I was very curious to know if you had any artistic input or influence in this book, especially on the cover. Like, did you like the cover of the book? Is there anything that you would have changed?
Well, there are a couple of things. Inside the book, there's a little drawing of a horse named Coco, and I could have drawn that, but they didn't want me to. But in terms of the cover, I had been given a cover questionnaire by Regal House, my publisher, and I filled it out elaborately with suggestions and ideas, none of which were used. They didn't use any of them. I had originally envisioned kind of a montage, like a line drawing montage, because I wanted to maybe see the Capitol and Ben Franklin and, you know, maybe some other things, but they completely ignored that. So when I did first see the cover, I really didn't like it. I was very disappointed. And I offered my publisher, I said, well, I can get an independent designer to work with. And she said, no. She said, we know, she said, book design is very different from other kinds of art. And we know what will sell. We know what will catch someone's eye. We know that this orange color will pop out on the shelves. And people will pick it up. So at first it looked very cartoonish to me, and I really didn't like it. It looked very sort of abstract and in a too loose a way. But now when I look at it, those things don't pop out to me as much anymore. Like this big shape of his chin, like just looked cartoonish to me. So now when I look at it, I think to myself, well, it really contains my book. It really contains everything I put into it. I can live with it. And a lot of people really like it. A lot of people, you know, think it's, you know, abstract in an interesting way. I'm curious what you think. What do you think of the cover? Be honest.
No, I actually like the cover. Out of all the books that we had read, there was not one that I think was as vibrant as this one. Mm-hmm. And I also like the mixture of blues and like beiges and oranges. It's very complimentary. Yeah. And I almost think it's like a bit symbolic even of all the themes in the book and all the different people. Of course, Ben Franklin, a lot of the main characters as well. So I actually do very, very much appreciate the art on the book.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear. I like what you said about how it reflects the content. I think that's true. And I think they are complementary colors. I'm a printmaker. I've since made some prints using those colors, and they do resonate, and they naturally, because they're pieces of one another. But yeah, I think I sent Liz an email this morning because the Kirkus Review magazine, you know, Kirkus is a big book reviewer, and they just gave the book a starred review, and they included sort of a big picture of the cover. So I think they must like it too. And again, it's hard. I'm sort of a quieter person. I'm sort of a line drawing person. And when I first saw this and it was like, boom, it seemed like it didn't suit me, but I think I'm changing. I'm learning to appreciate the bigger shapes. So, and also they're able to put this quote from André Debussy on the cover at the last minute. And so I appreciated that as well. There's a lot that goes into making a book. You know, I had to do the portrait and all the quotes and the description. It was because Regal House is a smaller press. There were many, many things I had to do on my own that maybe a larger commercial press would do for an author. So that was a learning experience as well. But I'm very grateful because a lot of people responded well to the book. I sent out review copies early to people, and I'm just grateful to a lot of people that they responded and were able to help. And I've been on a reading tour. I was just at the Boston Book Festival, which was really fun to read at. And I'm Zooming with a bunch of book groups. And I was the November pick of the Brown University Book Club of Boston, and just went to one live and one Zoom session last week. Mostly I'd say I'm just grateful that people appreciate the story, and I'm not being Pollyanna-ish about this. It just means a lot that the characters who I lived with for a long time and who I really struggled to do right by, that they resonate for people, that I found, I think what I feel about the book is, I think I found a way to convey enough sort of truths in me into my characters. And I think that people do respond to that. And I'm just grateful that these things stand up, and that the characters, that I did write by my characters, you know.
My question is kind of similar to that, actually. I find it very interesting just how you were talking about like your experience with just like the cover and going through the Regal House process. And while I was listening to one of your other podcasts, you were mentioning just about that different process it took to get what Ben Franklin would have told me in the publishing houses. And I'm curious, how were you able to get this book successfully published?
Well, that's a good question. It was actually a long process. The book was bought in 2019. And then this was the, due to COVID and the production cycle and everything, it took this long to come out. But before that, I had, usually what an author does is get an agent, and then the agent submits to editors. And I had an agent for another novel a number of years ago who had done that. And so I knew what the process was, but this time around the publishing market has changed, and it's actually a lot more difficult to get an agent. So I had sent my book, the manuscript, to several agents, and they all responded in different ways. There wasn't a lot of consensus about what they didn't like about it. They liked a lot of things, but they one person wasn't sure whose story it was. Was it Lee's or Tomas's story? And others just weren't willing to commit. I had received something called the New Letters Publication Prize, and they published New Letters as a literary journal, and they published one of my short stories called Primates. And at the last minute, after I had sent my manuscript to Regal, and Regal, the editor there, said she loved the book and wanted to publish it, this agent did want to take me on, but she wanted me to make a bunch of changes that I didn't feel I wanted to make to the story. So I decided not to go with her. So my answer to your question is, I tried to recruit an agent for this book, wasn't able to, sent to Regal independently. And again, it wasn't an email manuscript. I had to send the physical manuscript and wait for them to read it. And I decided to go with Regal because the response was unequivocal. The editor there, Janie Regal, loved the book. And so I decided, rather than keep listening to maybes and ifs and buts, I would just go with her. I think if I had gone with a larger commercial publisher, my book would be more visible, but I just didn't want to keep going that route. It was too frustrating and I didn't know if it was going to happen. So anyway, the answer is I went with Regal and I'm happy I did. There's some ups and some downs. They don't have a big budget. They don't provide marketing. Everything I've had to do to promote my book, I've done on my own. I did hire a part-time publicist who helped in the beginning, but most of what I did on my own, and I've been very lucky. So, I mean, ideally, if you can get an agent, that's a helpful thing, but it doesn't, I'm sort of proud of the way that going the grassroots route has led to probably as much success as I might have hoped for. I didn't get a New York Times review, but I got a Boston Globe review and I got the Kirkus Starred review, which I guess is a good thing. My launch was at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge and I was on the bestseller list there for 2 weeks. And I've done a bunch of readings at different bookstores. So I think I started working on the promotion last February. I sort of got a head start and just really worked at it. And so I do believe it's almost like a Cinderella story in the way that all of you responded to the book so well. I do think that the hard work pays off and there's not just one glitzy route to success, that one can make their own success. And so far I've been lucky. But I did, once Regal bought it, we did go through an editing process. We, you know, covered every page. And there was not a lot of line editing that was done, but there were some sections that were removed. I lost about 50 pages in the process. And I'm glad because there were some sections that were extraneous that I wasn't aware of really. And then once we were working together, it made sense. And I think less is more in most cases. And I think that this book is pretty tightly written. And so I think it was a collaboration, though. I'm very grateful for the help I got from my editor because she saw things that I didn't. And then it was just another pair of eyes to rethink the storyline. So that's sort of a long description, but I think it is pretty daunting today to try to publish a book. You know, I have a certain set of credentials that get me read. But then I think that agents are not taking as many chances on literary fiction right now. They're sort of looking at things that they feel will definitely sell. So it's sort of an uphill climb, but I think if you believe in your work, you just do it.
Thank you. And I guess this almost also like follows up my follow-up question that I have. What is your advice just for inspiring writers?
I think there are a couple of things. For me, a big part of being a writer is sort of hearing the music of language in my head, having a feel for language that doesn't want to stop, and a sort of a sensibility and an imagination that is a bit irrepressible. So if you're thinking in phrases and images, and you owe it to yourself to keep going with that and to nurture that. I think a lot of the important work in writing is done in revision. So I think that it you have to be willing to do that revision. I mean, I think, and also listen to criticism or constructive criticism if you're in a writing group, and be willing to revise and rethink things. It used to be that I'd write something and I'd think, okay, I don't want to change that because that's how I heard it. But that's totally out the window now, because you can hear it again. You hear it again and again and again, and reshape things and try to get closer and closer to the story you're trying to tell, and try to be honest about what's inside you, no matter what it is. You know, you have to be able to write ugly things and despicable things as well as good things, and give your characters equal time if you're writing fiction, and let the story play out in different ways in your mind. You might think you have one way that you start out with, but that's inevitably going to change. So I would say you need to stay open to changing things and reshaping them. There's someone in my writing workshop who was a wonderful writer, but she was writing fiction that was mostly autobiographical, and we'd say to her, well, maybe you can change it to say this for the purpose of the story. And she'd say, no, that's how it happened. But I think that writers need to be willing to give that up and think about the story as an overall shape or plot. And I think never give up. I think for me, I stopped writing for a while. I have 2 children. I had some hard times and was interrupted. And it was very painful not to write. And I think if this kind of writer who needs to write, you'll know it. And I think needing to write comes from a place that's inside you, not just once, but over and over, that you recognize as your inner self, and that you owe it to yourself to cultivate that. And then the publishing is great, but it doesn't always happen easily. And you just have to stick with it. If you've written a story, I think, and you have some literary magazines in mind, try to find the literary magazine that publishes things that are sort of like what you're writing. You have to try to match that with what you're doing. Are you writing short stories or a novel?
So I'm actually writing poetry and also fiction as well.
Yeah. So are you doing a poetry or fiction workshop in school?
Yes, I'm currently in one, and I know Professor Whiteacre teaches a couple of the workshops as well, and other faculty.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, read a lot of poetry, find the poets who resonate for you and with you, and just keep refining. Rilke had a saying, which I always kept in mind, which was ruthlessly compress. And when I was writing poetry first, I worked with a poet in college, a poet named Michael Harper, who was sort of terrifying. And he's sort of a big man with a big presence, and he was tough on us. And that was all for the better, because he helped us challenge ourselves and work harder and dig things out of ourselves. But I think the editing process in poetry is very important, and really, I'm not sure what kind of poems you write, but crafting images is a tough job, but it's you can always make them better, I think. And so trying to make them better and tighter and better linked, it was always something that I strived for. And my writing is sort of poetry that became longer sentences. And I wasn't willing to sort of give that up either, because that was my sensibility, to write in a sort of descriptive, imagistic way. And so I think even if you're writing prose, you can hold on to the language and keep reading. And even if it's a little bit every day writing.
Awesome, Donna Gordon. Thank you so much for your advice about just the writing process and about your book. Thank you so much on the behalf of the Whirling Book Prize judges. We really enjoyed your book. We were really immersed from the beginning, and as a top contender and now the winner, we were looking forward to meeting you as well. Thank you so much, Donna.
You're welcome.
Listeners, we hope you'll check out What Ben Franklin Would Have Told Me by Donna Gordon. You can learn more about this 2022 Whirling Prize in Prose winner at our website, which we will link in the podcast description. Thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to the UND Potluck Podcast, hosted by students and faculty of the University of Indianapolis. We would like to thank our guests as well as the Shaheen College of Arts and Sciences. To learn more about the UND Potluck Podcast and hear other episodes, please visit etchings.und.edu. Thank you for your support of UND students and the arts.